Imagine a bank vault, right? Like equipped with a 3-foot-thick titanium door, retinal scanners, armed guards, the whole nine yards.
Right, maximum security.
Exactly. But the actual cash, it's just sitting in a wet cardboard box in the alley out back.
Yeah, that's exactly what enterprise security looks like right now at, I'd say, most mid-market software as a service companies.
It really is. It's this total illusion of safety. You build up this massive defensive perimeter on paper, but the actual daily operations just completely bypass it.
They go right around it.
Right. And, if you're an engineering leader at one of these mid-market software as a service companies, so let's say somewhere between 200 and 2,000 employees, you know this contradiction intimately. This is your reality.
Oh, absolutely.
You probably have like a customer security questionnaire literally sitting on your desk right now.
Or a board of directors asking for an update on your AI policy.
Yes. Or an impending insurance renewal. And your primary defense for all of those inquiries is it's probably just a static AI policy document, like a PDF that somebody uploaded to a SharePoint folder 6 months ago.
Right, gathering digital dust.
Exactly. But meanwhile, out on your development floor, your engineers are actively shipping AI-generated code into production multiple times a day.
Yeah, the gap between that static PDF and the reality of a developer's daily workflow, it's staggering. Mm-hmm. I mean, regulators, enterprise customers, they do not care about a document that no one reads.
No, they don't.
They only care about what is actually executing in your environment.
Which brings us to the mission for this deep dive. We're unpacking this incredible March 2026 white paper by Encephalon, and it's titled The Governance Gap: Why Enterprise AI Fails Without Requirements Discipline.
That's a great piece of research.
It really is. So we're going to explore why treating your AI rollout like a standard software as a service deployment is, well, it leads to an 80% failure rate.
Yeah, massive failure rate.
Right. But more importantly, we are going to break down the actual solution here, which is how to encode your company's governance at runtime rather than just letting it rot in dead documentation.
And, what is genuinely fascinating about this research is that while generative AI feels completely unprecedented, like this brand new thing, the specific failure mode we're seeing on development floors today, it's not new at all.
Really?
No, it's the exact same structural failure that tanked enterprise data warehouse projects 30 years ago. I mean, we are literally watching the tech industry repeat history step for step.
Man, I definitely want to dig into that historical parallel in a minute. But before we talk about fixing the gap, we kind of need to understand the scale of what is actively breaking right now.
Because it's huge.
It's massive. We aren't talking about a few isolated pilot programs anymore. I mean, AI coding tools currently see 29 million daily installs. Yeah. Massive, highly regulated organizations are going all in. Like Salesforce rolled this out globally. Accenture built an AI group with 30,000 professionals. Cognizant is deploying AI assistants to 350,000 employees.
The adoption curve is just nearly vertical at this point.
Yeah.
But, and this is key, the white paper draws a very sharp distinction between merely adopting the technology, buying the seats, and actually succeeding with it. They point to what they call the Spotify signal.
Oh, right, the Spotify case study. This blew my mind. So Spotify achieved a 90% reduction in engineering time for cloud migrations.
Incredible numbers.
And they're pushing like over 650 AI-generated changes a month. But, and here's where I get a little stuck. The paper later claims that over 80% of an enterprise AI projects fail.
Right.
So how can the failure rate be that high when a company like Spotify is seeing these massive productivity gains? I mean, those two data points seem to completely contradict each other.
Well, it looks like a contradiction until you look at the prerequisite work that Spotify actually did. I mean, they didn't just buy licenses and hand them out to developers like candy.
Right.
They explicitly encoded their organizational context into the AI tools before they ever deployed them.
Yeah.
So that productivity wasn't like a native feature of the AI out of the box.
Oh, I see.
It was a byproduct of the organizational knowledge work. And when companies skip that encoding step, which, let's be honest, the vast majority do, the white paper identifies these three compounding failures that just take root immediately.
Okay, let's walk through those three failures, because the first one is just brutal on a purely operational level. They call it the Groundhog Day problem.
Yeah, that's a perfect name for it.
It really is.
Yeah.
So this is the reality that every single time a developer opens an AI session, the AI basically has amnesia. It starts from absolute zero.
Correct. I mean, the model might be brilliant at writing Python generally, but it has no earthly idea how your specific company writes Python.
Right.
So the developer has to sit there and spend time prompting the AI with, you know, your internal naming conventions, your specific architecture patterns, your security constraints.
Every single day.
Every single day.
It's honestly like hiring a savant level coder every morning, but absolutely refusing to give them the employee handbook.
Yes.
So your senior engineers just have to sit there and explain the basic rules of your code base before this savant can do any actual work. And the math they run on this in the paper is eye-opening.
It's terrifying, honestly.
Let's say you have a 200-person engineering team. If each developer spends just 30 minutes a day re-explaining context to the AI, that team burns 26,000 person hours a year.
Yeah.
Which, at a standard blended rate, means you are torching $2.6 million annually.
So burning it.
Just to tell a machine how you like your variables named. It's insane.
And, you know, that $2.6 million, it's strictly the operational waste. That doesn't even touch the risk profile. Which brings us to the second compounding failure, which is the blind spot.
Right, the governance absence.
Exactly. This is the complete absence of governance at the actual point of creation. Because AI, out of the box, will just happily generate code using insecure libraries or, you know, architecturally unsound patterns if it doesn't know any better.
But wait, don't we have manual code reviews for exactly this reason? Like, if an AI suggests something insecure, shouldn't a senior developer catch it before it gets merged into the main branch?
I mean, in theory, sure. If you have a 10-person team, manual code review works fine.
Okay.
But scale that up to a 200-person team that's using AI to write code at, like, 10 times their normal speed. The sheer volume of that AI-assisted output completely overwhelms the manual review process.
Ah, right.
Human reviewers suffer from fatigue. They just start rubber-stamping pull requests because they simply cannot keep up with the volume. So the AI is generating insecure patterns significantly faster than humans can catch them.
Which introduces massive vulnerabilities right under the nose of your security team. And that leads directly into the third failure, which they call the walking dead or knowledge attrition. This kind of gets back to that SharePoint PDF we were talking about earlier.
Oh, yeah.
The institutional knowledge of how your software as a service company actually operates, it lives in the heads of your senior engineers. It does not live in that document.
Because documentation is a static artifact.
Yeah.
The second you hit save on a PDF, it begins to decay. It's out of date.
Right.
And when those senior engineers leave for another job, their undocumented context, you know, the unwritten rules of how systems actually interact in your specific environment,
yeah,
that context just walks right out the door with them.
So the AI can't learn the rules because the rules literally aren't written down anywhere in a way a machine can ingest them.
Exactly.
This is where I want to loop back to your earlier point about history repeating itself. Why are we making these exact same mistakes? I mean, is it just a flaw in how we deploy modern software?
It's a flaw in treating AI as a pure technology problem, right? When it's actually a requirements problem.
Yeah.
I mean, engineering teams today are deeply, deeply conditioned by the agile methodology.
Sure.
The instinct is always just deploy quickly, get the tool into the hands of users, and iterate based on feedback.
But iterating on ungoverned code means you are just letting bad security patterns compound, right? I mean, the cost of remediating a vulnerability once it's merged into your main branch is exponentially higher than stopping it at the developer's workstation.
Exactly. Agile deploy and iterate is fantastic for user interfaces, but it is catastrophic for enterprise governance. And we have the actual data to prove it from the 1990s.
The data warehouse era?
Right. Back then, organizations were trying to build these massive enterprise data warehouses. And Gartner found that 85% of big data projects failed.
Wow, 85%?
Yeah. And the Standish Group showed that only 16.2% of IT projects succeeded.
That's wild.
And the root cause wasn't that the database technology was faulty. The number one cause was incomplete requirements. Companies would just buy the database platform, hire an administrator, and start dumping data into it without ever understanding what the business actually needed to measure.
And the white paper draws a direct line from that failure to today. I mean, they point out that the RAND Corporation reports over 80% of AI projects are failing right now.
Yep.
Which is twice the failure rate of non-AI IT projects and the number one root cause, requirements misunderstanding. We are literally paying billions of dollars to relearn a lesson from the 90s.
We really are.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the data warehouse industry eventually solved their 85% failure rate.
Oh, they did. How?
Through a discipline called the Kimball lifecycle. The core premise was simple but rigorous. You must gather cross-functional business requirements before you build the technical architecture. You have to understand the business process first, and Encephalon argues that the only way to fix the AI governance gap today is to adapt that exact 30-year-old discipline into what they call the integrated requirements methodology.
Okay, I need to understand how that actually works in practice. Like, what is the mechanism behind this methodology? Because I'll be honest, gathering requirements just sounds like standard corporate advice. What makes this different?
The main differentiator is a concept called bidirectional dependency.
Bidirectional dependency. Okay.
This methodology forces you to recognize that your AI feature requirements drive your data requirements. But, and this is crucial, the reality of your data absolutely constrains what AI features are possible. You cannot separate them.
The paper actually has a really great example of this involving a finance team that it really clarified the silo problem for me.
Oh, the invoice example. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So let's say your CFO wants a new dashboard showing revenue reporting broken down by product line. In a normal company, that gets routed to the data team as just a standard business intelligence requirement.
Right. Totally separate track.
Right. But at the exact same time, your accounts payable manager wants to use an AI tool to automate invoice reconciliation, and that gets routed to the engineering team as an AI project.
And in a typical enterprise, those two teams never talk to each other.
Never.
So the AI team starts building the automated reconciliation tool. But 6 months later, when they actually go to launch the thing, they realize the tool is just hallucinating constantly.
Because the vendor master data is an absolute mess.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The AI initiative fails entirely because the underlying data requirement was never met.
So how does the integrated requirements methodology prevent that scenario from happening?
By mandating cross-functional executive stakeholder interviews before a single license is ever deployed.
Okay.
You sit down with the CFO, the accounts payable manager, the security lead, and you map all of their disparate needs onto a single artifact called the Enterprise Bus Matrix.
Let's visualize this matrix because it sounds complex, but it's actually incredibly elegant when you see it.
It really is.
Imagine a large spreadsheet, right? Down the rows on the left side, you list every major business process, like processing invoices or closing the quarterly books.
Right.
And then across the columns at the top, you list the core dimensions of your business. So your customer data, your vendor data, your employee data.
And the matrix becomes this annotated map of dependencies. You just put a check mark in the grid where a business process relies on a specific data dimension.
Ah, I see.
So instantly, you can look at this and see that the CFO's revenue report and the AP manager's AI invoice tool both heavily depend on the vendor data dimension.
Which completely shifts the bottleneck. I mean, we spend so much time talking about how many tokens an AI model can process or how good its reasoning engine is.
Yeah, the tech specs.
Right. But this matrix proves that the model's capability isn't your constraint at all. Your constraint is your own messy data.
Precisely. And yeah. Building this matrix alongside the actual stakeholders is how you solve the massive trust deficit we're seeing right now.
Oh, the trust factor.
All right. A recent Fortune survey found that 54% of workers actively bypassed their company's sanctioned AI tools in the prior month.
Over half.
Over half. And only 9% actually trust AI for complex decisions. I mean, workers are losing 51 days a year just to technology friction.
That's depressing.
It is. But when you use this matrix to build requirements with them, acknowledging the reality of their messy data, the system you build actually reflects their daily workflow.
Mm.
Trust is established because the tool solves their actual friction rather than just forcing a generic AI on top of a broken process.
Okay, so we've mapped the dependencies. We know what the business needs. But I'm looking at this from the perspective of our listener, right? The engineering leader who is trying to satisfy an auditor.
The real world pressure.
Exactly. How do we take that matrix and actually enforce it so that developers can't accidentally ship a vulnerability? Like, how do we move from mapping requirements to what the paper calls the governance closed loop?
Well, this requires moving governance from a static document into runtime enforcement. And the methodology demands two distinct interlocking layers. The first layer is ideological enforcement.
Ideological enforcement.
Okay. So this is governance by context.
Break down the mechanics of that. What does ideological enforcement actually look like in the code editor for a developer?
It means encoding your organization's specific technical conventions directly into the AI system prompt or configuration layer.
Okay.
So, for example, let's say your engineering leadership spent a year deciding that your application must be built as a modular monolith.
Meaning all the code lives in one unified deployable unit, just highly organized internally.
Exactly. You explicitly chose not to use a microservices architecture because it adds way too much operational complexity for your team size.
Makes sense. But a generic AI doesn't know about that historical decision. So if a junior developer asks it to build a new payment feature, the AI might suggest spinning up three new microservices just because it read on the internet that microservices are popular.
Exactly. And that's where ideological enforcement intercepts it. Because you encoded the modular monolith rule into the tool's context, the AI is structurally constrained during the generation phase.
Oh, I see.
It will only suggest code that fits a monolithic architecture. But importantly, the loop doesn't close there. It also enforces the rule at the review stage.
Right.
When that developer submits a pull request, the system uses those exact same encoded rules to validate the code.
It's like an automated architectural review board.
Yes, exactly.
But ideological enforcement only covers the style and the structure of the code, right? It does not actually physically protect the data.
No, it doesn't.
And that is where the second layer comes in, physical enforcement.
Right. Physical enforcement is governance by interception. This is a literal middleware layer that sits directly between the developer's workstation and the AI model's API. Before a developer's prompt ever reaches the external model, this middleware physically intercepts the traffic. It scans the payload, it strips out personally identifiable information, it blocks any live database credentials, and it redacts API keys.
Wow.
And crucially, it maintains an immutable audit log of every single interception.
Now, I'm trying to think of why you couldn't just pick one or the other. Like, if you have physical enforcement stripping out all the bad stuff, why do you even need ideological enforcement?
Because they mitigate entirely different vectors of failure. I mean, physical enforcement is incredible at stopping a tired developer from accidentally pasting a live production database password into a chat window.
Right. It blocks the credential leak.
Exactly. But a middleware interceptor doesn't know how to code.
Mm-hmm.
It has no earthly idea if the developer is using a modular monolith or microservices. It can't prevent architectural drift.
Ah.
Ideological enforcement stops the architectural drift, but it can't physically intercept a leaked password. So if you only implement one layer, you are leaving a massive vulnerability wide open.
Right.
And honestly, a sophisticated enterprise customer reviewing your security posture will fail you instantly if you lack either one. Because regulators are going to look for those core governance objects.
Right. The four governance objects. We're talking about sanction model lists, verification thresholds,
jurisdictional standards, and human acceptance authority.
Exactly.
You need all of that encoded.
Which completely changes the conversation with the auditor. I mean, you aren't just pointing to a SharePoint PDF and promising that your developers read it.
No, you have session-level audit provenance.
Yes. Session-level auditable logs proving that every single AI interaction was physically intercepted for secrets and ideologically validated against your architecture rules. It proves your AI is a tightly controlled workflow, not just a black box.
And that level of control is what allows you to implement what the paper calls environment-aware security gating.
Yeah.
Because a governance system understands the actual context of risk.
Yes, this mechanism is brilliant because, okay, if a developer is working in a sandbox dev environment and they ask the AI to generate a script that drops the database table, the system recognizes the low-risk context.
Right.
It might flag a warning, but it allows the action to proceed so the developer can actually test their work.
But if that exact same developer issues that exact same prompt, but the target environment is production.
Oh boy.
The governance layer physically blocks the execution, refuses the prompt, and automatically escalates an alert to a security manager. The security response is entirely gated by the environment context.
And speaking of security, the paper establishes a hard rule regarding how AI handles credentials, which they call secrets management by reference.
Yes, this is critical.
Explain how that mechanism operates under the hood.
It means the AI tool must never, under any circumstances, store or have access to the actual plaintext string of a password or an API key. Never. It should only possess the reference pointer to where that secret lives in your secure vault. So the AI knows that the database credential is named Vault Object X.
Okay.
It can write code that calls Vault Object X. But because it never actually sees the password itself, it is mathematically impossible for the AI to accidentally hallucinate or leak that password into a code suggestion.
That is such an elegant safeguard. But I'm stuck on a practical issue here. We talked earlier about the Walking Dead problem, the fact that company knowledge rots really quickly as systems change and people leave.
Right.
If we spend all this time encoding our architecture rules and our environment gates into this governance system, how do we keep the system itself from becoming a stale artifact in 6 months?
Well, by building it to be self-maintaining through a mechanism called live knowledge and domain-specific routing.
Okay.
If your governance framework requires a human to manually update a central repository every single time an architecture rule changes, the framework will fail. It just will. It must be dynamic.
How does domain-specific routing actually execute that, though?
Think about a developer asking an AI coding assistant a highly specific question about your internal network configuration.
Okay.
A standard AI will just hallucinate a generic networking answer. But a governed AI with domain routing recognizes the intent of the prompt. It intercepts the question, routes it directly against your internal networking team's specific knowledge framework, retrieves the current standard, and uses that to formulate the answer.
Oh, wow.
So it is continuously querying the live state of your internal domains rather than relying on a static training cutoff.
Okay, the technology to execute this, the middleware, the contextual routing, the matrix, it's clearly documented. Mm. But the white paper emphasizes that the real barrier to implementing this isn't technical at all.
No, the technology works.
Right. The barrier is organizational change.
Mm-hmm.
So if our listener wants to actually fix their governance gap this week, where do they start? Because it sounds like you can't just buy a vendor tool and turn it on.
You absolutely cannot. Step one is totally non-negotiable: executive sponsorship. If you do not have an executive champion who has the authority to force cross-functional participation, do not even begin the project.
Really? Why is that authority so critical? Are teams really going to fight that hard over a new tool?
Well, they won't fight over the tool itself. They will fight over the unwritten conventions. When you start trying to encode your organizational rules, you inevitably discover a massive gap between your official corporate style guide and the unwritten rules that your senior engineers actually enforce during code reviews.
Right, the real rules.
Exactly. Uncovering those hidden rules forces teams to confront their own inconsistencies. Surfacing those gaps, arguing over them, and forcing a final decision on what becomes the encoded standard, that is deeply uncomfortable work. You need an executive sponsor to break the stalemates.
And this leads directly into what the paper calls the build versus buy track. If you're an engineering leader, your first instinct is likely, my team is brilliant, we understand webhooks and APIs, we can just build our own middleware interception layer in a few weeks.
And technically they are right. The physical wiring of intercepting an API call takes weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But the methodology design determining exactly what needs to be encoded, mapping the business dependencies on the bus matrix, resolving the tribal conflicts between teams, tuning the environment-aware gating, that takes months of painful trial and error.
Yeah.
If you try to wing it internally, you're going to spend a year relearning lessons that this methodology has already solved.
So Encephalon outlines a strict three-phase sequence to roll this out without falling into that trap. Phase one is strictly about the integrated requirements. This takes 3 to 6 weeks of those cross-functional stakeholder interviews.
Right.
You are building your enterprise bus matrix. Crucially, you do not write a single line of code during this phase.
You are just mapping the business reality. And once the matrix is built, you move to phase two, delivery by subject area. You do not try to deploy AI across the entire company at once.
Right. Don't boil the ocean.
Exactly. You pick one vertical slice of value. For example, the finance subject area. You deliver the clean data models, the reporting, and the AI capabilities just for finance.
And the mechanical advantage here is that the first subject area takes the longest to build. Let's say you spent a month building the vendor data dimension for finance. When you move on to the supply chain subject area next, they also need vendor data.
Yep.
But that dimension is already built and governed, so the delivery velocity literally accelerates the further you get into the matrix.
Which culminates in phase three, operational maturity. This is the end state where the framework is self-maintaining, domain routing is active, and the organization is finally operating with governed, auditable AI workflows that satisfy both the engineers and the regulators.
Okay, let's tie all of this back to the reality on the ground. If your AI policy currently lives in a SharePoint PDF, but your developers are actively shipping AI-generated code to production, you have a massive, unmitigated governance gap.
Huge gap.
To survive your next enterprise customer security review or insurance audit, you have to implement a governance program of record at runtime. You need ideological enforcement to constrain the AI's architectural choices, and physical enforcement to intercept sensitive data before it ever leaves your environment.
Exactly.
And you cannot do any of that without first capturing your requirements through cross-functional interviews.
Because if you fail to encode your organization's specific context, you aren't actually building an enterprise AI capability. You are just renting generic intelligence while your own company's deep operational expertise evaporates.
Which brings us to a final thought I want to leave you with today. Think about the most experienced senior engineer on your team right now. The person everyone goes to when a complex system breaks because they just know how it works.
We all have one.
We do. If they won the lottery and quit tomorrow, how much of your company's actual operating logic walks out the door with them? Are you using AI merely to write generic boilerplate code a little faster? Or are you ready to use this technology to systematically encode your company's deepest operational DNA before it disappears entirely?
That is the defining question for any engineering leader navigating this transition.
It truly is. Well, thank you for taking this deep dive with us today. Take a hard look at your own development floor this week. Ask those uncomfortable questions about where your operational knowledge actually lives, and we will catch you on the next one.